Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey. Hey there, ice bath lovers. Do you want to take your cold exposure game up a notch with some contrast therapy? Well, you should, because cold plunges and contrast therapy can lower stress, up your immunity, and even help you sleep better. It works better than just cold therapy alone. Well, now you can do that with the new Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tubs by Master Spas. Whether you want to relax in a hot soak or get energized with a cold plunge, the Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tub has you covered. You can easily hop out of the hot water, get in the cold water, and go back and forth. When you do that, you get better results in less time, and that's what biohacking is all about. Go to chiligoattubs.com, use promo code DAVE500, and you can save $500 on any Chili Goat cold tub. I have one in my backyard. That's chiligoattubs.com, promo code DAVE500. Everyone's talking about red light therapy beds, and for good reason. There's a company called ARRC LED that's building an entirely new class of LED devices. ARRC LED beds integrate proprietary scanning technology and frequency protocols to shape the delivery of six different wavelengths in dose-optimized photobiomodulation. Yes, that's a lot of words. What it is, though, is that photobiomodulation improves the underlying energetics of the cells in your body. And those changes can benefit nearly every tissue and organ and system in your body. You change your cells and you change your life. For more information, visit arrcled.com.
Hey everyone, it's Dave Asprey of Bulletproof Executive Radio. And you might notice if you're watching this on video, not just listening to it in your car, that I'm at Huffington Post Studios sitting next to Arianna Huffington. Arianna, thank you for being a guest on Bulletproof Radio and for hosting us in your studio.
I'm delighted to have you here, and I have my Bulletproof cup. Oh.
Thank you. You wrote a book that had me so excited. I saw you interview with Joe Polish, who's a friend of mine, and I'm a member of his mastermind. And I said, Joe, you know, please introduce me to Arianna, which is a big ask because I know how hard it is to get a hold of you because you're pretty popular. 10 weeks straight, New York Times bestselling book called Thrive. But your book was such a cool book that I sort of kept at it because it seemed worth it to connect on that level with you. Why did you write your 14th book about thriving and about things that are maybe very different than your other books? We'll just jump in.
So really, I wrote it because of my own personal experience of collapsing from burnout, sleep deprivation, and exhaustion 7 years ago, hitting my head on the way down, breaking my cheekbone, getting 4 stitches on my right eye. And that started me on this journey of asking big questions that we often stop asking after we leave college, like, what is success? What is a good life? And while by conventional definitions of success are successful, if you come to in a pool of blood and nobody has shot you, by any sane definition of success, you are not successful. So that was really how I came up with the third metric of success. You know, the first two metrics of success are money and power, but this is like trying to sit on a two-legged stool. Sooner or later, you fall off. And the third metric, the third leg of the stool, is about our well-being, wisdom, wonder, and giving. And starting with well-being, we now have incredible scientific findings that make it very clear that contrary to the collective delusion we've been living under, burning out is not the way to be most productive and ultimately most successful, that we pay a very heavy price in terms of our health and well-being if we simply do not take the time to sleep, to renew ourselves, to connect with our own strength and wisdom, which is the second pillar of this third metric.
That's definitely a big vision in order to talk with people about connecting there. But you sold your company for $300 million, which makes it a little easier to focus on those things. I had a similar experience when I was 26. I made $6 million. And then I lost it when I was 28. Because, well,
you maybe if you had slept more, you wouldn't have lost it.
You know, that is a totally reasonable argument. The reason I did it is actually what you're talking about, striving. I told myself, I have $6 million. At 10, I'll stop. Which is ridiculous when you're 26. I think $6 million is enough for the average 26-year-old to kind of like do fun stuff. But I didn't even travel much. Like I was just working. And that was when I read your book. That really resonated with me. You were also, you know, very focused and all that. But what do you say to someone who's, you know, 25 and looking at maybe some student loans, wanting to get a car that doesn't break down all the time, and just getting going in their career and working 60 hours a week, two jobs, because they want to make ends meet? You know, there's all these things they want to do, but it takes money and all that. How do you connect the message in your book back to someone who's still working on making sure that they have quality food?
Absolutely key question. And that's why I have a whole section in the book where I address this question, even going further than this. You know, people in extreme circumstances who've lost a job, who are facing real adversity. I even have examples from people in concentration camps. Because the point of my book is that wherever you are in your life, whether you are at the top of the world dealing with multiple demands on your time and attention, or whether you are struggling to make ends meet, we need to remember what they tell us on the airplanes. Put your own oxygen mask first. And when we put our own oxygen mask first, we connect with that center that we all have, and where we are at our strongest, wisest, and where we can operate at our most productive and most creative. Because if you look at really how we spend our time, we waste an enormous amount of time by being distracted, by being tethered to our devices. Even the fictional person that you mentioned who is trying to get a car that doesn't break down, et cetera, has more discretionary time than he or she thinks. You know, somebody's watching House of Cards. So it's just that at the moment, our culture hasn't really convinced people, because it's driven by this delusion, that the more we actually prioritize connecting with ourselves, the more effective, productive, and creative we're going to be. Nothing in my book is about chilling out under a mango tree.
Yeah.
And if you look at my schedule, I'm clearly doing as much and I think accomplishing more because I now get 7 to 8 hours sleep. Because I do take time to meditate and walk and do yoga and whatever it is that works for each one of us. You know, this is not any kind of dogma. Each one of us needs to find out what's our own cocktail, you know, what are the things that by putting them together, we can operate from what has been known as the zone or being in the flow, or we have multiple expressions for this state of being. And we all kind of know when we are there, but a lot of the time we don't know how far away from it we are. I mean, I sometimes joke when I look at my iPhone and I have this very exact reports on the state of my iPhone, like 20% battery remaining, 17% battery remaining. You know, by about 13%, I get anxious and I look around for a recharging shrine, lest anything happen to my iPhone. But the truth is that when I collapsed, I must have been below 0% battery remaining, and I wasn't even aware of it.
Yeah. This is something I haven't talked about, but I had something remarkably similar happen. I flew to China, gave a talk, flew to Florida, gave another talk, slept 2 hours, hopped on a plane back to San Francisco because I wanted to see my kids, and the security line was so long that I didn't get water and I didn't get coffee, so I was basically fasting the whole time. So I stood up on the airplane, passed out on the aisle, and I remember, of course, I didn't hit my head on anything on the way down, but I remember when I woke up, I was so mad because someone was rousing me from the most like peaceful sleep I've ever had. I'm like, I'm just sleeping here. Couldn't somebody just let me sleep? But that did kind of scare me. This was a couple of years ago. And I knew it was because I was so dehydrated,
yes,
just because I didn't buy a bottle of water. But you can run to that limit.
And right.
You learned how to find where that limit is for you by experiencing it the hard way. And I've done something similar there. How do you recommend that other people learn to know when they're approaching that 13% battery life? What are the signs or the metrics that someone who hasn't been there
right.
would look for?
Well, first of all, I hope that people watching or listening now or reading Thrive or reading what you're writing will realize that they don't have to have their own wake-up call before they can bring about
Please
changes
don't.
In their lives. You know, we can learn from each other's wake-up yeah. calls. We can learn from each other's mistakes. We don't have to make every mistake. And also, we can learn from science. This is why this is such an exciting moment. We now have incontrovertible scientific findings about these things. And that's why in Thrive, I have 45 pages of scientific endnotes deliberately because I wanted to convince the most stubborn skeptic that this is not some kind of new agey, flaky, Californian stuff. You know, this is actually hardcore, rooted in science and proof that if we want to be the most productive and creative we can be, if we follow these steps, and I have 12 steps in the book, mm-hmm. and I chose 12 deliberately because we are addicted to the wrong way of living. But if we follow these steps and we can take them one at a time, we can actually see transformational changes in our lives. And the steps are deliberately very small, very doable, really microscopic. And we can all pick whichever most resonates with us. I picked adding 30 minutes to my sleep every night until I got to 7 to 8 hours. And I began to feel and act so differently that was its own reward that has now made me be so committed to prioritizing that. And that may mean that I didn't watch House of Cards last night, or I didn't watch Jon Stewart, or I gave up when I'm traveling on having dinner with friends. So sometimes it means giving up good things. But the fact that today I'm completely present here with you, that I feel recharged and enjoying what I'm doing and fully participating rather than, as so often used to happen to me in the past, kind of dragging myself through yeah. my to-do list and my meetings and then crashing at night. So I just feel that there is no trade-off.
Now, here's an interesting question
yes.
for you. If you could take an anti-aging vitamin that gave you that half hour back, you got the same amount of sleep in a half hour less time, and it didn't have harmful side effects, would you take it?
I don't believe it. I think mm-hmm. that...
I'm not trying to sell
yeah,
a makeup
no, no,
one.
No,
I'm just
no,
like,
no.
as a hypothetical idea.
I'm just
like,
saying that, unfortunately...
Yeah.
I believe that anything we take, anything we put in our bodies, unless it's herbs and vitamins.
So magic turmeric juice or something. I'm saying if there was a nutritional intervention or some other thing like that, a non-harmful one, that let you get that half hour back, would you take it or would you
well,
still
right
get the
Well, right now
sleep?
It's a lot more than half hour because,
okay.
you know, I went from 4 to 5 hours
mm-hmm.
to 7 to 8 hours.
That's a lot.
So that's a lot. But I'm infinitely more productive. And creative. And the biggest growth of the Huffington Post happened after I was getting 7 to 8 hours.
Oh.
Because I was completely clear, for example, about where we needed to go. Like, I was clear we needed to become a global media company. 3 years ago, we were only in the United States. Now we're in 11 countries, and we have over 90 million unique visitors,
wow.
and almost 50% of them are coming outside the United States.
That is so impressive.
And I can give you many other examples,
yeah.
which I'm only doing, to show that as a leader, the more connected you are to what's your vision for your company, where you want to go, and being clear about that, and also seeing the red flags or the icebergs before they hit the Titanic, the more successful your company will be. So if you look at how many startups fail, you know, 3/4 of startups
oh, yeah.
fail, and startup culture is notoriously driven by sleep deprivation and burnout, maybe there's a connection here.
There certainly is. I remember as a young entrepreneur in Silicon Valley, the pizza and beer fueled things were.
Yes.
And I finally had to reject that, although I'm definitely a fan of getting more sleep and less time. Just sleep efficiency is a big thing for me. But I finally was just like, enough, because that's hurting my performance at least as much as not getting good sleep. Where if you're not fueling the body right and you're not doing basically recovery protocols, whatever they are, it all kind of ends up somewhere. And I just kind of shudder when I see people who are making the same mistakes I did when I was in my early 20s, because it doesn't, I mean, your startup will succeed or it won't. And if you, you know, live on peanut butter for 6 months or something ridiculous, which I've seen, it doesn't mean you're a better person, but there's a certain like badge of courage, especially among young men, where it's like, you know, I beat the crap out of myself, and that's part of how I like prove myself.
There's definitely a big macho component here.
How do you counteract that? Like, how do you teach young men in order, like, how do you teach them to not basically destroy themselves?
I think we need two things. We need new role models.
Okay.
We need to show them the science.
And you did a great job, by the way, on the science in your book. You qualify as a biohacker for sure. Like, you really got the data, which thank you for doing that, because this is the hardest message to get through, especially to younger type A people who have the most to benefit from learning.
Right. And also, I think when you also look at the cost we are paying, you know, the cost in terms of our health, the cost in terms of good decision making. I quote Bill Clinton in the book, who said, "The most important mistakes I made when I was tired."
Yeah.
And he did not specify what mistakes, but we can all look at our lives and say something similar. You know, when I was tired, you know, I would hire the wrong person or be overreactive to something that happened. You know, all the things that.
Yeah.
That happen when you're not operating from a centered recharge place. And of course, nobody's ever going to be operating from that place 100%. So I'm not asking for anything that is utopian. The question for me is, how quickly can we return to that place?
And in the way I think of things, I use the word resilience a lot.
Yes.
Because it's fine if circumstances knock you over, as long as you bounce back up.
Absolutely.
It's when you stay down because you can't get up that something was wrong.
And that's why, to go back to your first question about people who are struggling, that's when you need to be resilient more than ever.
Yeah.
Because we see that the same negative fact can completely destroy someone, while someone else can thrive through it. I mean, I have a study in the book of the Illinois Bell Company that fired 25,000 people at the same time. And the University of Chicago tracked what happened to them. And three quarters of them kind of fell apart. And the rest thrived. You know, they went on to start their own companies, to find better jobs. It was the same adversity, but people reacted differently depending on how resilient they were, on how connected they were to their own inner strength and wisdom.
Doesn't a lot of that resilience come from your mother, like from your very early childhood experiences? When you look at the work of Hans Selye, I don't know how to say his last name, I just read it, but the father of modern stress research and epigenetics and all. So some people seem to come in with, I mean, they're bulletproof when they're born, and they come into the world and they do whatever they want and they're always on top. And other people seem like they're, you know, fall down, get up, fall down, get up.
I feel that anybody can transcend their circumstances and their how their parents brought them up or all these things. I think we are all bigger than that. Of course, we are very blessed if we have parents who brought us up a certain way. I feel very blessed to have a mother to whom the book is dedicated, who brought me up not to be afraid of failure, to take risks. She used to say failure is not the opposite of success, it's a stepping stone to success.
What a lesson.
But you also see in the world an enormous amount of people who had terrible childhoods and have been able to transcend them.
Yeah. It's possible for everyone, in my experience. Being aware of where you are on that spectrum,
yes,
is also helpful. It turns out I'm probably weaker than average in that I used to weigh 300 pounds. I had arthritis in my knees when I was 14, and I had all sorts of chronic stuff. And I fixed all that, but
right.
it took $300,000 and 15 years of work to do it. But it is doable.
Right, exactly.
But if you don't know, and I didn't as a young man, I didn't recognize I had any weaknesses. You know, I'm smart. I'll be an entrepreneur. I'll do my own things. But I hadn't developed the self-awareness that was necessary to do that, which is why your book is really cool, because you're sort of saying, look, I'm a pretty successful person. Here's all the, you know, here's my path and how I did that. But if people get that message, like, plot where you are on the spectrum of resilience and figure out where you can improve. And you've got your 12 steps in the book, like maybe sleep more. And I would totally support that. I'd also say sleep better, like turn your thermostat down and make the room dark.
Yes. But
there's,
oh, yeah. No, no, that's yeah. very important. I have actually a list of,
oh, do
of
tell.
About, I think, 12 things you can do mm-hmm. to sleep better. I mean, I have a little ritual myself, and you can find your own ritual depending on what works for you. But I have a transition period. I think very often we have no transition yeah. period. Like we are on our laptops or our iPad, and then we turn off the light and expect to go to sleep. So for me, some of my rituals involve a hot bath. I have mm-hmm. a hot bath where for me it's like soaking the day away. And it's like that day is done with all the things that were good in it and all the things that were bad in it. And now it's the period of transition. And I totally agree with you. I make my room completely dark.
Oh, good.
If I can't, I wear an eye mask.
Do you pick hotel rooms based on how good the curtains are?
Yes.
I do
and
too.
And also, you know the other thing I do? I travel with a selection of scarves that I drape over the little blinking lights that are everywhere.
I travel with the electrical tape, and I just take a little square and stick it on there, so...
That's good.
It's a lot
That's
lighter.
Easier. Yeah, I should get some electrical tape. And I was recently at a hotel in London, the Firehouse Hotel, that just opened, and I absolutely loved it because it was very old-fashioned. They had no screens in the room.
Oh, wow.
They had an old-fashioned phone that even rang with an old-fashioned ring.
That's cool.
And then by the phone, on a little the hotel writing pad, handwritten was a message, for anything you want, dial 0.
How simple is that?
So, but what was great is that you could get into bed and there were no blinking lights anywhere because there were no screens. And so darkness is very important. Lowering the temperature, as you mentioned, is very important. Another thing for me is I have nightwear. I mean, I used to sleep in my gym clothes, mm-hmm. and now I sleep in my sleep clothes.
So that's part of signaling
to
your body.
Signaling to my body, you're going to sleep. You're not going to the gym. And a friend of mine actually was Cindy Levy, the editor of Glamour, and, mm-hmm. and she and I did a sleep challenge, and we wrote about it. And one of the things, she sent me pink silk pajamas. But whatever it is that signals to your body, you're going to sleep. So, and a lot of other things, like a good pillow, etc.
Yeah.
Whatever it is to make your sleep more effective, I completely agree with you, that is key. And then another thing that's equally important for me is when you wake up in the morning, do not immediately go to your email.
Yeah.
That is key. In so many ways, including saying, I'm in charge of my agenda. The minute you go to your email, it's like saying, I'm in charge of the world's agenda. And whatever is important to you and you and you and you, I'm going to handle before I even have my cup of coffee.
It's true. It's so distracting to just jump on email in the morning. So you track your sleep, like the number of hours of sleep. Do you use one of those alarms that wakes you at the top of a sleep cycle or any of the other things, like number of steps per day? Like how much do you
get data
by yourself?
Oh, yeah. I have a Jawbone that
okay.
I use. But I mostly agree with Professor Rattenberg from the University of Munich. I quote him in the book, who's done research that shows you know when you've slept enough because you wake up without an alarm.
Yep.
So So it's really very simple. I mean, these days I wake up without an alarm.
That's got to be pretty crazy on your calendar, or do you just know yourself well enough to know you'll wake up in about 8 hours? Because if you have a 9 a.m. meeting and you wake up at 9:30...
Oh, no, I mean, I do put an alarm as a precaution.
As a backup. Okay.
Yeah, as a backup.
Cool.
Yeah, yeah. But I always wake up and turn it off before it goes. And I prioritize going to bed based on what time I have to wake up. So I don't have a specific time I go to bed. It depends on whether I have to get up at 6 or 8, you know.
So you go to bed earlier. You don't stick to the fixed bedtime.
Mm.
This is fascinating. I've had the opportunity on Bulletproof Radio to talk with all sorts of different high-performance people, like people who are on tour in bands and pro athletes and all. And it's not something that you often hear executives talk about, like, how do I go to sleep at night? But it's one of those things that, for me, has shifted dramatically over the last 10 years as I started getting more data, and you look at the research, the stuff you're citing in your book. And it turns out that there are a good number of very successful people who realize, like, I get more out of every day.
Exactly.
Like, I'm nicer to other people if you do something as simple as improve your quality or length or both of your sleep. What are the other big things that you, maybe kind of low-hanging fruit from your book that people would want to learn about? The audience for Bulletproof Radio, it runs, it's roughly half men, half women, across the whole age group, starting around 20 going up to about 60. So it's a broad spectrum, but what would they benefit from knowing about the most, other than just buying your book, which you should do. Thrive, it's a good book.
So another low-hanging thing, one of the 12 steps, is at the end of each day to find something, well, it could be resentment, grudge, or a project that you're not really going to do, and drop them.
Oh, wow.
It's like dropping something that no longer serves you. You know, that grudge you've been carrying around, does it really serve you? I have a quote, not you personally.
I hear you.
A quote from Carrie Fisher in the book. She said, resentment is the poison you drink thinking the other person is going to die. Or a negative fantasy about the future. You know, so often we have these negative fantasies about what's going to happen. And as Montaigne said, there were many terrible things in my life, but most of them never happened. So letting go of something that we fantasize about, that we worry about, but it's a fantasy.
So that is remarkable. You're going straight to forgiveness, essentially. When you drop a grudge, you're forgiving whatever that thing was. And in my own life, I've worked on the steps to forgiveness. And gratitude, for me, is something that comes before forgiveness, because I always found it hard to drop a grudge until I could find at least one good thing that came out of it.
Mm.
It's like, oh, I lost $6 million. Like, okay, I learned an awful lot when I lost, so I can be grateful that I lost $6 million because it, you know, put me on this whole different path, right? And it's that gratitude that lets me then progress to the forgiveness step and, you know, dropping the grudge and, you know, refusing to carry someone else's burden, which is really what that grudge is.
That's great. And I think... I completely agree with you. I think gratitude is grace. And living in a state of gratitude for me is living in a state of grace. And it's a constant process. It's definitely one of the steps in Thrive. My daughter that I write about in the book, who got involved in drugs in her last year at Yale, and we took her out, and she's been sober for 2.5 years, and she decided to write about it to help other young people. But one of the things that helped her in her recovery was doing a gratitude list every night that she shared with three other friends, and they shared their list with her.
Oh, that's powerful.
And that was very powerful. And she continues to do that. And in our family, you know, around meal times, you know, remembering and stating what we're grateful about is just very key. So I completely agree with you.
I've started doing that with my 4.5-year-old and my 7-year-old before bed. We pick three things in the day that we're grateful for.
That's fantastic.
And I'm really working to build that practice. And of course, I have to tell them my three, and they tell me theirs. And it's amazing some of the things that they'll say they're grateful for, because you get little nuggets of wisdom from the kids. So I have no idea what that'll mean when they're, you know, 20 or 30, but I'm
Well, it will
hopeful.
Definitely be ingrained in them, because we are, our minds so often go to the negative. And that definitely had sort of an evolutionary purpose. Like if you're being pursued by a lion, mm-hmm. you'd better focus on the lion rather than the rainbow in the sky.
Right.
But it's now far exceeded its usefulness, because we remain in a perpetual fight or flight mode, even when, in fact, there is no real danger around.
Yeah.
And, you know, I also mentioned in this step dropping projects that we're not going to invest ourselves in, because that's also another energy drain.
It's a huge energy drain. How do you manage that? So I am running a very small company, and I would get 10 phone calls a day if people could find my number from people who wanted, you know, do a deal or whatever else. So I've put some filters in place. Not that I don't want to talk to all those people, I just don't have the hours in the day. And I imagine the pressure on you must be about 1,000 times greater than that because of your status as a media figure. How do you filter all those inbound opportunities? And they're almost countless. My mind, I think, would probably start to explode and creak a little bit if I was subjected to the same, like, inbound. Well, it's positive pressure, but it's still pressure. What's your practice for filtering that?
Well, here's what is so interesting, that when I am in this centered place that we described earlier, and we all agreed nobody's going to be there all the time, then I have a lot of clarity about what I'm going to be involved in and what I'm not, including things in my personal life that I might want to be involved in. That's what I mean about dropping projects. Like, just to give you a personal, silly example, you know, I always wanted to become a good skier, and I'm a lousy skier. And one day when I was doing these regular mini life audits, I said to myself, you know what, I'm never going to invest enough time and energy into becoming a good skier. So this is a project that I'm going to drop. And it was very liberating. It was like saying to myself, you can complete a project by dropping it, by telling yourself, this skiing is done. So now when my daughters want to go skiing, I go with them and I sit by the fire when they're skiing and I drink hot chocolate and I read a good book. And I have no residual, oh, one day I must become a good skier.
So you're not dealing with any sort of guilt or should have
or even just residual, I'm going to put some energy into this one day feeling. And the same applies to projects at work. The same applies to unfinished books or anything. You know, it's like we don't have to finish something. If this is no longer serving us, we can complete it by dropping it.
When you drop it, do you make a conscious decision to drop something versus delegate it and make it someone else's problem?
Oh, yeah. I mean, okay. I wish I could delegate becoming a good skier, but I couldn't.
If you figure that one out, let me know.
I mean, I think delegating is key. I think having a good leadership team, so that, for example, when in the around Christmas I was in Hawaii with my daughters and my ex-husband, I'm also very big in co-parenting, mm-hmm. beyond divorce. And we have a divorce section here that focuses on that, because mm-hmm. with so many marriages ending in divorce, it's important to learn that, because otherwise your children pay the price.
Yeah.
So there we were on vacation, and I was doing a digital detox for a week. So I was only checking email twice a day with the office. So that meant having a team in place that I could delegate things to and trust that they would deliver, and if needed, they will get in touch with me.
You said the T word, trust.
Yes.
So how much of that week did you spend with fear that the people you were trusting would not follow through?
Or none did you at have all, because okay, I already have that team in place. You know, I wouldn't have done it if I didn't, and there were many times when I didn't.
Got it. So you built the confidence first.
But I think, yes, okay, you build the confidence, you build the team. But that's part of, I mean, any leader who thinks they can micromanage everything, they basically are saying, we cannot grow.
Yeah, they're not a leader at that point.
Yeah, because also growth is dependent on the ability to delegate and have a team in place.
That is true. You wrote a lot in your book about the different effects of stress on women and women in the workforce, which is, I would say, something that's underserved.
Yes.
When I read about human performance and even things like paleo dieting and all that, like it's very kind of, you know, thump your chest sort of stuff sometimes. When I look at what it takes to be a good entrepreneur, one of the kinds of energy that at least I feel or envision, it's a nurturing kind of energy to a company. And I honestly, being a father and a CEO, it's a lot of the same, sort of like your company is your baby, not like your actual baby, but it's something that you've put so much energy into. Do you feel, as a mother and, you know, a CEO, that the energy is similar? And is that why it's so much harder for women sometimes to do this, you know, power, money, the sort of the different things you write about in your book, in order to do this, and why so many of them sort of step back? Is it because there's only so much nurturing energy they have, or they aren't taking care of themselves?
I think, what the recent scientific findings are telling us is that women internalize stress differently. So women in stressful jobs have a 40% greater risk of heart disease and a 60% greater risk of diabetes. And I was so struck by this scientific finding that I used it twice in the book, you know, in two different contexts, because I feel we really need to pay attention to that, because as women, it means we have less of a margin to live life from a stressful, burnt-out place. And one of the reasons is that, we all have that voice of judgment and self-doubt in our heads, but in women it's particularly loud and harder to basically shut off. I call this voice the obnoxious roommate living in my head. And, I've dealt with it to the point where it now only makes guest appearances. But I think it's really important to recognize that, because that voice drains a lot of energy and increases stress, we have less margin.
It's that voice is something that I hear with my coaching clients. All of them have some degree of it or another. And there's so many different techniques, most of which revolve around meditation or some sort of therapy, around turning it off or turning it down or gaining control of it. And certainly a good amount of it comes from the body itself. Like, you're starving, the tiger is going to catch you, or what, those old primordial messages that we have. And then some of it comes from a more conscious place. And I was entirely unaware of that when I was younger, because the voice has always been there, like, the voice is you. And then recognizing that, well, wait, it's kind of not me.
Yes,
and it's really separate and annoying.
And it doesn't speak the truth.
Yeah. What's your advice for people who want to learn when their voice is telling them the truth or not? Is there a trick you found?
Well, yes. Again, it goes back to learning to steal our minds. We're never going to stop our thoughts.
Yeah.
It's just that when we also have a reference point of stillness, we don't have to follow every thought and become its slave. We're talking about becoming slaves. Becoming the slaves of technology is also something which is one of the big problems of our time. You know, you and I both come from kind of technological backgrounds in one form or another. Here we are in a 24/7 media company, which is also a technology company. So we are both very aware of the glories of technology and everything that has been made possible, but also I'm acutely aware of the dangers of being perpetually tethered to our devices.
Yeah.
And what that does in terms of our inability to connect with ourselves and our loved ones. And that's why one of the steps in the book is at the end of each day, pick a time when you turn off all your devices and gently escort them out of your bedroom. There has to be like a sacred space at night when you just sleep. And I've gone further than that, and I only have real books by my bed. And I love to read books that don't have to do with work before I go to sleep, which often may just be for 10, 15 minutes. But I love to read poetry and philosophy and novels, and just basically reminders that however great our jobs and however lucky we may be that we love our jobs, we are more than our jobs. Like if you didn't have your job or if I didn't have my job, that doesn't mean we wouldn't still be in our essence who we really are.
Yeah, you'd be exactly the same person, just yeah. doing something different. It's pretty profound given how much we identify, especially as we get more successful that way. I got my MBA at Wharton, and there's been a couple of big layoffs since then. And it's kind of amazing when you get, you know, the big degree and you know, you're whatever, a management consultant or a banker or an entrepreneur or a VC, whatever it is. And then all of a sudden it all stops. And looking at it, the impact on friends when that's happened, and even on me when things have gone the way I didn't plan in my career, it almost feels like you've died. Mm-hmm. Like it is an enormous stress. And yes. You've seen the WHO list of stressors. And losing your job is like, almost like losing a loved one in terms of the way we take it biologically, but it's all fake. Like we take it that way biologically because that little voice in our head took over.
Yes.
And I found as I learned how to master my brain, often using technology to train myself to do that, I went through a layoff once where I was working for a publicly traded company. I helped plan the layoff. I knew I was not on the list. And at the last minute, they added me to the list. For good reason, because I had a team that was awesome, so they could do my job, and I kind of expected that. But I was annoyed, and I would have taken that personally and just been devastated and you know held a grudge for years. But I'd just done enough that I sat there for a little while, and I said, all right, I went home, and I told my wife, Lana, I said, I've got great news. And she goes, what is it? I said, I get to take some time off. And it totally didn't stick. And that was like the first time in my career that something like that had happened. And it was because I had gained some of that inner awareness, the yes. control over that, instead of just, you know, being reactionary, just being like, I'm not this job, even though it's, you know, kind of a fun job.
Well, and also, even people who are like you were at that time were able to support themselves for a period without the job. Even they are feeling an incredible pressure to immediately get another job. I have friends of mine who have made a lot of money, and then something happened, they were let go, or there was a change in their careers, and they suddenly find themselves with time on their hands and the opportunity maybe to take that time to decide what they want to do next, but they're very nervous about taking that time and not being in a job. And I was recently on doing Super Soul Sunday with Oprah, and she asks everybody the same question, which is, what do you know for sure? And what I said to her is a version of what we're discussing here, which is I said that what I know for sure is that no matter how magnificent your job is, Oprah, or how good my job is, who we are in our essence is more magnificent.
Wow. That is profound. There's a question that I've asked everyone who's been on the show. And so that's more than 120 people now. And I'm dying to know your answer to this. And the question is, given everything you've learned, not just in Thrive, this book, or your career, just at life's lessons, the three most important pieces of advice you would offer to people who want to perform better. I don't mean perform better at work.
Yes.
I mean perform better as human beings doing whatever it is they're here to do. Only three. What would they be?
So, the first thing is that we are more than our jobs. That is the first thing. And to really be fully aware of that and to give ourselves some time to actually connect with that reality and that truth, because so often we give ourselves no time at all to connect with that essence that Archimedes, you know, the Greek mathematician, said, give me a place to stand and I can move the world. And we all have that incredible place of strength and wisdom and peace, but we need to honor it and give ourselves some time to be in it and live our lives from that place. And the second is what I already mentioned, which has to do with failure. My mother's advice that failure is not the opposite of success, it's a stepping stone to success. And the third one is something else my mother taught me, which is don't miss the moment. Because that's the one thing we know we have for sure. Life is much more fragile than we think. And we don't know when things will change for us. And unfortunately, we all think that by multitasking, we're going to be more efficient. But this is a complete lie we tell ourselves. You know, multitasking doesn't make us more efficient. It just makes us miss the moment. And it doesn't really exist. You know, scientists have told us that multitasking is really task switching.
Yeah.
It's the most stressful thing we can do. And yet, we all think that that's a badge of honor. It makes it clear how busy and important we are, that we can't just be doing one thing at a time.
So it all comes back to ego at the end of the day, because you feel like you have to do it to be a good person. It's a tricky path to navigate. When people want to buy your book, is there anywhere they should go in particular? Because I want to make sure that people who are listening to this do get a chance to read it, because I interview a good number of authors, but I think you really nailed it with this book. You put the science in to back it up. And you've just got a unique perspective that I haven't seen in a book like this. So I really appreciated it. So if you're listening, you should buy Thrive. But is there a thrivebook.com or some URL? I should know this, but I don't.
Thank you so much. No, you can buy it from a bookstore. You can buy it from Amazon. You can buy it from barnesandnoble.com.
Okay.
The only thing that we have is a site, huffingtonpost.com/thrive.
Okay.
That shows where I'm going to be speaking next. So if anybody wanted to come, then they would find out by going to huffingtonpost.com/thrive where I'm going to be next. And also, I wanted to invite anyone who is listening or watching who may want to write about these things and tell us their stories, whether it's stories of burnout and wake-up calls or stories of how they thrive, to do so. And you can email me at Ariana. One R and two N's, at HuffingtonPost.com, because I believe that by having this conversation, by sharing stories, we'll be able to accelerate a shift that's already happening.
The shift is happening, and your book is helping. So, Ariana, thank you for writing your book. Thank you for being
thank
on
you.
Bulletproof Executive Radio today. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
If you haven't had a chance to learn about our new sleep induction mat, check it out on the website at upgradedself.com. It helps me get to sleep faster and very specifically to get more deep sleep.
The Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.